Well, hey out there to all you aspiring social entrepreneurs, and welcome to the Voices of Social Change. This is the podcast for you if you are a startup social entrepreneur looking for tools to grow your venture. Well, hey again, and welcome to the Voices of Social Change podcast. I'm your host, Josh Shookman. I podcast this thing proudly from the Kansas City Startup Village, an organic startup community right here in my hometown of Kansas City, Missouri. Would like to welcome you to the Voices of Social Change podcast. This is for you if you are an aspiring social entrepreneur. It's here that we host interviews with the world's leading social entrepreneurs so that you can learn from the best. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump right into part one of this interview. If you're tuning in for the first time, I break it up into parts. So this is part one, and tune in later on this week if you want to catch part two. Hey, Change Nation, and welcome back for this great interview here today. I am with a really, really unique social venture. A lot of the social ventures we talk about, you know, they're having a kind of like a clothing line or something along those lines, but we have a really unique product that we're going to be chatting about today. I am here with the founder of Yellow Leaf Hammocks. His name is Joe Demon, and the motto of Yellow Leaf Hammocks is do good, relax. Because with your support, Yellow Leaf is on a mission to change the world from the comfort of a hammock. So each Yellow Leaf hammock they make directly empowers artisan weavers and their families. And I'm going to read just a little bit more about their mission because I really love it. They say, in addition to sustainable social change, we believe passionately in travel, naps, good food, great friends, long talks, broadened horizons, and a spirit of adventure. Which if I had to pick a mantra for social entrepreneurs, I'd say that nails it too. But Joe, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks a lot for having me here to share our story.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking really forward to hearing it. And like I said, I think you have a lot of unique perspectives to bring to the table that's really different from a lot of individuals we speak to on here. So I'm really excited for this. Now, I've given everyone just a bit about Yellow Leaf, but why don't you go ahead and take it away? And first, talk to us about you, because we do want to get to know you. And then go ahead and move in and talk a little bit more about Yellow Leaf than I just did here.
Yeah, absolutely. My official title is Chief Relaxation Officer. So I don't have necessarily a background in retail, social entrepreneurship, or anything in this realm. And I started out my career in finance, real estate development, but it was always intrigued by social impact and products that had an impact, you know, in whether it's through just its use in your daily life, and just wanted to do something different and, you know, have a greater impact with my life, you know, the short time that we have on Earth. And so that's kind of like the very high level overview of what I did before, and I'm happy to speak more towards that if you'd like. But basically, yeah, like, what can I tell you? There's so much to share on myself and on what we're doing at Yellow Leaf. So,
well, one of the things we're always really interested in, Joe, you mentioned your background pre-social entrepreneurship. So can you tell us about the aha moment where the switch was flipped and you decided, this is what I need to do with my life?
Yeah. I think there were a series of events that led up to my initial trip to Thailand where I came up with the idea and everything that came after that. But I guess leading up to it, you know, I worked in commercial real estate development, and you know, we built communities and in big buildings and residential and commercial projects, and that touched, you know, the cities that we worked in and had an impact in that area. And as I started researching or getting more involved in that space as a career, looking at like green building and affordable housing development, different things like that, that can have a greater impact. And I worked at more of a traditional financial firm that didn't really look at those things. But we, through myself and a few other younger people in the company, we actually switched the entire mission of the company, and the company became the leading sustainable developer in the Midwest, as well as the largest developer in the Midwest at the time. And we actually saw leasing go up, and we saw financial return, on implementing those different things. And I was really pumped about that because I always had this idea of fusing like socially driven initiatives with traditional business practices, and with this idea that, yeah, you can actually have traditional returns, maybe even higher returns than you would normally, and also do good. And I didn't think that the two should be mutually exclusive. And so we did that. You know, that kind of led to the next thing where I started just seeing what was going on in the world. Like Tom's Shoes at the time was just starting to become a business, and this idea of fusing charity into your business model was becoming more mainstream. And I just had ended up working more on affordable housing, and also seeing that you can have traditional returns but also create housing for people in need. And I thought that was amazing. And what really sort of locked it in for me was when I went on this vacation with a particular friend of mine who was already she had been working in the organic food industry, and she organized this epic trip to the Grand Canyon, and we brought together 30 of her people in her network, who some of them were successful company founders who worked in whether it was like sustainable food or, you know, similar fields, and they were doing things that were really inspiring, kind of like a lot of the other people you've interviewed on your show. And so I met in particular the founders of Sambazon actually through that vacation, and some other people who had this amazing story of being on vacation, coming across a product, and taking that and bringing it to the U.S. and then developing a whole supply chain that benefited the area where that product was being made and radically transforming lives there. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, if only I could think of something like that. And so I went back home and continued on my finance job, and basically was starting to get burnt out, like a lot of people around 2006 and onward when I graduated, you know, working a lot of hours and so forth and doing something that, yeah, was meaningful but wasn't having as greater of a, or direct of an impact that I wanted. So long story short, I decided to take a vacation to Thailand, where I came across one of these amazing hammocks that we sell today, and came across this hammock on a little beach and was struck by the quality, because I had been looking for hammocks back in the U.S. and, you know, most hammocks on the market are factory made. They're more of a commoditized product, and here was something that was actually far more comfortable, well designed, beautiful. And so I asked a bunch of questions and learned that it was part of a development project to help a hill tribe that had previously been enslaved, and that through this project they had started weaving hammocks and perfected the hammock weave and actually created enough jobs to break free from exploitation and debt slavery, and I even started employing the same tribe that had been exploiting them. And so I was like, that is amazing. They're making this product that's better, that's beautiful, and they're having this impact. So I, basically, that stuck with me that on that trip. And a week later, I decided to ditch my friends and convince the cab driver to actually drive me 600 miles to the village where this hammock was woven. And it all basically changed for me from that point on.
Yeah, I love that story. And you mentioned on your website, your cab ride was one of the longest cab rides in the history of the world. So a 600-mile cab ride.
It was, I don't know. I haven't, obviously don't know who that cab driver was, but I would love to have heard the conversation he had with his wife when he returned home that night.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there are a couple of things I want to latch onto there. And these are themes that I'm continuing to hear as I chat with folks, as I chat with social entrepreneurs around the world. And the one theme is this idea of travel and being influenced by trips you take and by having that light get switched on by taking these trips. But also, I think that the second piece was you got into a cab and went 600 miles away from your friends, away from the central part of your trip, because you knew there was something to be found out there. There was something else driving you there. And I think that when we have those moments in our lives, it's really, really important to listen to them. And it's also important to be open to those opportunities when they come along, because that's just something that in one way or another, every social entrepreneur I've chatted with has that story. Now, like you mentioned, you're probably the only one who's gone 600 miles in a cab to find it. But I think one way or another, everyone has their cab story of that time when they just knew they needed to go and figure out what this was all about. So, yeah, great stuff. So what would you say that social entrepreneurship means to you, Joe?
I think that's a very broad term that gets thrown around and used in a lot of different ways. So I think for me, you know, honestly, I think I'm still trying to, it changes all the time, because I pay attention to how social entrepreneurship is continuing to grow and changing. And but for me, I guess it means having a business that, you know, first and foremost, I think it's when you have to assume this is not a for-profit venture, and it's a venture that is focused on positive impact as much as it is on profitability and making a great product. You know, those three things are equal to a certain extent in social enterprise. And when we look at impact, I think there's a lot of different forms of social entrepreneur enterprises out there. You know, there's the give back model. There's the model that Yellow Leaf has, where we have very direct impact in a community. And so I think it's fair to say that that can range. But in general, that's like the overview that I see it for, you know, the definition of a social enterprise, having those three things equally aligned. And maybe even for a lot of social enterprises, they go even further than a simple give back model, because to me, honestly, that borders on a CSR campaign within a larger, you know, traditional corporate enterprise. But that's, I guess, a separate conversation. I won't go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you sharing that, Joe, because I think this is really important for us to consider, and really leads me into another question that I had. As a lot of us are looking at establishing our own social ventures, I know that's a question that we grapple with right away. And I've chatted with cause-minded startups, and this is something that they really go back and forth on, is what kind of a giving model should they have? And I think it's a really interesting point that you make about the one-for-one model potentially just becoming a CSR model, whereas you're more deeply involved in the community. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But for now, can you just take us to that moment when you decided on your giving model? How did you decide to do it the way that you did it?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's not like a conscious decision that we had to implement this sort of giving model. We expanded our impact focus after we started growing, but what was happening before I came into the picture were that this tribe, the Malabri tribe, had already been weaving hammocks. They created the enterprise essentially, where as a way to take, you know, have financial stability and control over their lives and community, and improve their the situation that they were in. And so we took what they had created and adapted that to other communities as we grew, because we saw this as a very holistic development approach. Whereas if I had just simply been inspired to launch any hammock company and just create more of a product-driven business, we would have looked at, okay, where can we manufacture hammocks? Who's making them now? And we probably would have gone to a traditional factory. And then if we wanted to be a social enterprise, quote unquote, we would have probably, the easier thing to do is say with every purchase, we will donate money to a particular cause. Sometimes it aligns really well if you're, you know, a few companies do this really, really well, like Listen Headphones, you know, they have a really great one-for-one model where they have a very close relationship with a nonprofit that's a leader in the space, and they provide hearing aids and solutions to people who need it. So there's a good alignment there. But oftentimes, you know, someone will come up with a one-for-one model, and it's not really thought out. They think there's a marketing benefit there or something. It's not as authentic. And I think, you know, that's something that if, you know, there are any aspiring entrepreneurs out there, you know, something to really consider, has to be authentic. For us, it was already engraved in the founding of the company. And so there was nothing to do but go up and even take things further, which we've done with, you know, our microfinance program and some other things. But so hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And there are a few nuggets I want to land on there and just highlight. Number one is this idea that from what I was reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but the program to help the tribe that wove the hammocks, at least at some level, was there, and you found it, but then saw another really beneficial layer to put on top of that, and that was getting these hammocks out into the world and creating that access to more of a worldwide market. And so to me, that's a really good lesson in the sense that when you're creating your cause-based startup, you don't always have to think about totally reinventing the wheel. And I love that story you told about your friends at the Grand Canyon, and so many of them had traveled, and one thing that they had done was they brought different products back from these different countries and created the supply chains for them, rather than trying to create a product and create a supply chain, you know, which is not always necessarily the answer. And so I want to highlight that, because for those of us tuning in, you know, if you're hearing this, think about ways that you might link up with something that already has a good foundation in place and is a natural fit for you that you can then really bring to the next level. That might be a powerful way to get your social venture started up. So I think that to me is a really key point. And then the second thing that I want to highlight, and I really appreciate you mentioning this, Joe, is this idea of the need for authenticity. Because we're starting to see it, I think, more and more now, of exactly what you're talking about, where companies are just viewing this as some kind of a marketing tool. The good side of that is that there's a lot of transparency out there now, and I think that cause-minded consumers are pretty aware of the fakers and react to that pretty quickly. But it just, I think, highlights, though, the need to be absolutely authentic in what you're doing and why you're doing it and why you're weaving this social cause in. And not only because that's, you know, people will appreciate that, but also because, to me, that's the way that you'll stand the strongest chance of continuing to grow your movement, continuing to impact people, and really building a sustainable mission around what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that you've really hit on two of the most important initial tests that people need to do as they're thinking through the structure of their startup.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and I guess to add to that, I think as you were just saying all of that, another thought occurred is that I think if you do have a one-for-one model, that's fine. It's obviously better to provide something to somebody who needs it than to do nothing and just, you know, to the old way of doing business. But I'd say the businesses that have done a really good job in executing that mission, you know, there's an end goal in mind. It's not, because oftentimes those models get a lot of negative feedback from people from like the development community and, you know, the aid organizations and others, because it's in theory provides a band-aid solution. So I think, you know, if you're developing a one-for-one model, really think through who you're partnering with and what is the end goal. Like, how are you, if you're providing food to somebody, you know, for every meal or every food product sold, you provide a meal, for example, you know, well, how are you going to end hunger in wherever you're giving? You know, there has to be a goal to actually end hunger, not to just give things away and move on, and then like what is that person going to have after you give them a meal, you know? So it's and that's really difficult to do, and giving things away doesn't strike at the root of the problem oftentimes, but it can do a lot of good as well. So it's just, you know, having that authenticity, really thinking through everything from a more holistic perspective is important. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate you mentioning that. And I'll just latch onto the example you shared of Listen Headphones as having a great one-for-one model. We actually chatted with Bridget, the founder of Listen, on here too. And one of the things that was really striking to me was just that, how effectively she did that. But they partner with the Starkey Foundation. And I think that the Starkey Foundation's motto really says it all. The Starkey Foundation's motto is, "So the world may hear." And to me, that really shows what you're talking about here, Joe, is that she has partnered with an organization that has that mission, that understands the big picture and is really trying to impact it on a lot of different fronts. And Bridget also, as a founder, manages to make the time once every quarter to go travel on the trips with Starkey and actually see the impact and help with the impact. And so I think you're exactly right to cite that as an example of really all the pieces coming together with a one-for-one model. And so if that's a route for you, great, but just make sure you do the things that Joe's unpacking for you here.
So, yeah, exactly.
Good stuff. Well, so then just the last question along these lines of structure and model, you know, we'll talk about the B Corp certification here in part two, but for now, just talking about the legal structure of Yellow Leaf Hammocks, did you find it necessary to go after anything, or is there anything in California like a B Corporation legislation or L3Cs, or what was the conversation around that?
Yeah, well, when we were just launching the business, you know, we did what was simplest and quickest to start a company, which is become an LLC. And we didn't fundraise, we didn't go after any traditional sort of venture capital or angel investors. We just started doing it right away. So we did what was quickest. And B Corp certification was just becoming a thing around the time we were launching. B Lab as an organization was lobbying to make benefit corporations an actual legal entity that was similar to an LLC or C Corp. And now, a few years ago, actually, they passed the legislation here in California. And that's been amazing. And I think, I forget how many states have now passed it and are legally recognized benefit corporations as an actual entity. But I think great way to go. It's huge, especially, I think, for larger companies. For us, becoming a B Corp was pretty straightforward because, I mean, we had social impact was at the core of our foundation. So there wasn't so much a need to become a B Corp to, I guess, do better or anything. It was more about having transparency for us. But I think for larger companies like Patagonia, who are several hundred million dollars, if not a billion, in revenue and our global brand, becoming a B Corp ensures that those values are written into their bylaws, and investors and people, investors don't have, or they basically are, your mission is equal to your profits, you know. And so I think it's even more important for larger businesses than it is for a smaller startup like Yellow Leaf to become a B Corp. I think as we grow, it's great because the impact assessment allows us to revisit our various policies, from hiring to our impact outside of the communities that we work in, and more so on like our corporate policies and things like that. And it really also provides a complete overview of your business and makes it all transparent on their website.
Got it. Yeah. No, that's perfect. And I appreciate you sharing, because I know that's a big question for a lot of us as we're starting up is how to structure that. So my last question in this section then would be, take us to, you know, we know that establishing a social venture is full of a lot of great stories and great successes, but along the way there are challenges and there are setbacks. So take us to one of the largest setbacks that you feel you've had and what you learned from it, how you grew from it.
Oh, that's a great question. Let me think about it. So what have been the largest setbacks and how we've grown from it? I think Well, we've always been all about taking action and just going out there and getting things done. You know, not really spending, you know, months to develop a business plan or doing some sort of product testing. You know, we go out and we sort of rapid prototype is the phrase for what we do. And that's been great because we've learned a lot. But I'd say one of the biggest setbacks has been that, I mean, we're constantly, we've been bootstrapped since day one. And so we literally started the business with $1,000. And have grown from there. And there are constant setbacks in having limited resources. It also creates, on the positive side, it creates some discipline and it forces you to really evaluate how you spend all your money, what the return is on the things you're doing and so forth. But it also creates some challenges that I think I wish we maybe, you know, could overcome. Like, you know, honestly, I think maybe in just this year we developed our first catalog, and we're a product-driven business that was operating for 2 years without a catalog. You know, things like that. Not having the resources to go out and print catalog was tough, and that provided setbacks. So there's a lot of setbacks, daily setbacks that we had relating to lack of resources. And on the one hand, I always tell people bootstrap as long as you can, you know, don't raise money. And if you have a product to sell, go to your customers first and sell that product versus going, spending the time to fundraise. But on the flip side, I'm also sometimes now starting to think that, you know, maybe it would have been good to try to raise some sort of fundraising. Equity doesn't always work for a social enterprise because there isn't a sort of exit you have in like a tech venture. But trying to get creative, whether it's through a crowdfunding campaign or something to make sure that you have the necessary resources to grow, because we've had some, I'd say, pretty slow and organic growth. And now we're really starting to accelerate things now that we've proven out our business and been able to reinvest at a greater pace. But the challenge there has been just sort of crawling when knowing that you can put on some running shoes and go a lot faster, for lack of a better analogy. So that's one. And actually, now as I'm thinking that through, on the other side, a big setback that we did experience, and this would probably applies to any sort of artisan-based enterprises. In 2013, we had pretty explosive growth and things were really like coming into place for us. And it forced us to, this was really good. On one hand, we went from having about 50 weavers in the beginning of the year to growing to employ 200 people in Thailand. And that growth did come at a price, because we ended up opening up a lot of retail accounts, and some accounts were pretty large, and they weren't necessarily repeat sales for us. It was more of a one-time thing. So we scaled so fast that we found that a lot of weavers that we ended up hiring were temporarily out of work. And we saw that the negative impact that actually had. And we quickly learned from that. And what we've done from that experience, what we've done since that experience, is really work towards diversifying our sales more. So we're not dependent on any particular account. That way, if one drops off, you know, we can continue providing work and ensuring long-term stability for the communities we work in. But that was definitely a tough lesson, but I think we came away stronger from that. And I definitely would really want to, you know, share that with anybody trying to develop a similar business model.
Yeah. Well, I think you've shared lots of amazing insight right there for us in Change Nation, and great stuff for us to take as we're starting up ventures. The one thing I want to land on, and this is a personal thing with me too, because I work with a lot of startups here in Kansas City, is this idea of funding and getting some venture capital. And my feeling is there's a tendency to really want to do that right away in the early days. But you make a great point, Joe, in that a lot of times, and I've seen this more often than I would like, is that, you know, a company will get funding and then they'll go after things and, you know, they'll get that cash and then they'll go after things that don't necessarily drive the business forward, but because they have the cash, those things seem like necessary things. But when you're bootstrapping and when it's your money, you're a lot more diligent, I think, about some of the things that you need to be doing. And I love that idea, you know, going out and just talking to your customers first and getting something that they want in their hands and building it that way. I think these are things that happen when you are bootstrapping it, that it becomes a little harder when you get kind of flush with cash. And I know I'm generalizing, you know, all of us have to decide what's best for our own ventures, but I will say that's a general thing. And even if you are going to go after some venture capital, just always be thinking of that as your money and doing your due diligence in terms of the things that you're doing and talking to customers and asking yourself whether or not this would move the business forward. And if you'd actually spend the money on it, if it were your money and if you were bootstrapping and pulling it out of savings, I think is a great question and something that's really important to do. Well, good stuff. So that'll close us out of part one of this interview. So Change Nation, we'll be back with you here later on this week. Be sure you tune in for part two of this interview with Joe, where we chat more specifically about yellow leaf hammocks. And of course, as always, we'll close out with the rapid fire questions and let Joe give us a few of the resources he's using to knock it out of the park at Yellow Leaf Hammocks. So talk to you soon.